Auntie and I harvest our crops of beans, potatoes, carrots, and beets. We gather herbs and hang them to dry in the attic. We pick grapes, pears, and apples. Every apple I pick reminds me of O'Neill, the apple tree child. I can no longer tell myself that I think of him only as my brother. I love him. And when he returns, I will most certainly not tell him. Here on Landfair Mountain, too many miles from wherever O'Neill may be, even the nosiest gossip fails to mention Marin's odd hands being revealed by the medicine show woman. For that, I am exceedingly grateful. Marin is changing. Osbert follows her about, hanging his head and whimpering. While Auntie and I work, Marin sits in the shallow end of the wishing pool if the weather is fine, or on a chair with her feet soaking in the washtub if there is a chill in the air. She must always be touching water now, as being completely dry causes her anxiety and discomfort. She is losing her voice. Her loudest words come out as a whisper. And the fish-like scales no longer hide beneath her skin's surface. Cool to the touch, they adorn her sides in silvery green layers. She hobbles on feet that are closer to fins. When the pain of her body's transformation causes her to weep, tiny pearls fall from her eyes. She catches them in a bowl and buries them in the garden when she thinks Auntie and I are not looking. The garden is full of little mounds, as if an army of very industrious moles has taken up residence there. I am glad we live 2 miles uphill from the village and rarely receive callers this time of year. But what if someone were to arrive and catch Marin unawares? She could not run to safety on her unwieldy fin feet. She could not fight off even a salamander in her weakened state. In a few weeks, Marin and I will be 17. I desire no gift more than the return of Scarf and O'Neill. Their presence would lift our spirits and distract Marin from her sufferings better than any medicine. And with any luck, O'Neill will bring some potion, pill, or enchantment to heal her, as he has sworn to do. Day after day, I listen for the sound of clanging pots and pans and the music of Scarf's fantastic collection of wind chimes. I dream of it and awake disappointed. Chapter 6. Christmas is next week. Auntie is stirring a pot of spiced apples on the wood-burning cookstove. The kitchen air is warm, and when I breathe in, I can almost taste the cinnamon, cloves, and fruit. I knit clumsily, my stitches uneven and lumpy, while Marin dozes in the rocker at the hearthside. Her feet, which no longer look human at all, are soaking in a bucket of warm water. Bits of silver on her cheeks and brow catch the firelight. She looks beautiful and tragic, ill yet perfect. Osbert bays like a hound and hurls himself into the cellar just before the pounding begins on the kitchen door. I throw a blanket over Marin, covering her from her neck to the floor as the visitor lets himself in, uninvited. "A happy Christmas to you," says Simon Shumsky. He presses a wooden crate into Auntie's hands and then removes his hat. "Mother sent you a fruitcake, a jug of elderberry wine, and her greetings." His attention quickly turns to the shawl-covered girl. "Is she feeling poorly, Mrs. Amsel?" Marin opens her eyes.
"Oh, hello, Simon," she whispers.
"Well, thank you for stopping," I say. I grab his elbow and attempt to steer him toward the door, but he is built like an ox. And this ox is bent on getting closer to Marin.
"I am in no hurry to go, Miss Clara," he says, brushing past me.
Simon gets on one knee beside Marin, his square face inches from her sparkling cheekbone.
"I came to ask you to the Christmas dance, Miss Marin. Father says I can use his new carriage. Your sister can come along, too. I bought a new suit last week just for the occasion."
His adoring, eager smile makes me feel quite sorry for him.
"Too sick,"
Marin mutters. Her eyelids close.
"Well, You have 8 days to get well. Doesn't your aunt have the cure for everything? He places a small box in her blanket-covered lap. I brought you a Christmas gift. I've been saving it for months. Her eyelids flutter.
Thank you,
she whispers. I am sorry, Simon, I say. She simply cannot stay awake at times. It is her condition. I am sure she will enjoy opening your gift later. He stands, still wearing the same lovesick face he always wears in Marin's presence.
I will pick her up for the dance on the 26th at 3, Mrs. Amsel. And Clara, too, if she cares to go.
Auntie puts her hands on her hips. We do thank you for your kind invitation, but Marin is too ill to go to the dance, Simon.
Surely the sickness will pass, he says. I will say many prayers, and I know you will nurse her well.
If I may tell you a secret, I plan to announce our engagement at the dance.
She has not agreed to marry you, I say. She would have told us if she had.
Simon fingers the buttons of his woolen coat.
She has implied her consent. She likes to tease me, and that is why she pretends to refuse my offers. I know I can make her happy. I swear I will.
Auntie puts an arm about him and somehow maneuvers him to the door.
Good night, Simon. Thank your mother for the foodstuffs, will you?
Before he can don his hat, he is outside. Auntie shuts and locks the door.
I've never seen a boy so smitten, Auntie says, turning back to the stove and stirring the preserves.
Perhaps I should brew him up something to relieve him of that. The box rolls off Marin's lap and I pick it up.
Can you do that?
Infatuation is easy to cure, if that is his problem. A little dandelion root, a sprig of harefoot plant, a shaving of nutmeg, and a drop of moonrose nectar mixed into a cup of chamomile. True love is another story, I'm afraid. There is no cure for true love.
I thought as much, I say. I turn the little box over in my hands, and I think of my long-absent, much-missed friend O'Neill. I wonder if I could be cured of my feelings for him. It is not at all what I wish.
Chapter 7. I recognize the thick, muffled feeling of snow in the air before I even open my eyes. I roll over to wish my sister a Merry Christmas, but she is absent from the bed we have shared since we outgrew our extra-wide cradle. After slipping on woolen socks, hideously lumpy, made by me, and a robe of purple Chinese silk, last year's Christmas gift from O'Neill and Scarf, I hurry to the kitchen. The aroma of Auntie's special Christmas apricot scones meets me halfway. With her thin feet in a festively painted coal scuttle filled with water, Marin sits at the kitchen table. She has roses in her cheeks and a bright smile on her lips. The sash of her pink silk robe is tied in a huge bow.
Merry Christmas, sister, she says, offering her cheek for a kiss. Her voice is stronger this morning. I am certain of it.
Isn't this a Christmas miracle?
I embrace her. My ear to hers, I hear the sound of the ocean. I draw back with a start.
Doesn't she look lovely? Auntie says.
She sets a steaming plate of scones on the table beside jewel-colored jam and a saucer of pale yellow butter.
I brewed up a tisane of dried kelp, crushed shark's tooth, and powdered mussel shells. Perked her right up.
And look, Marin points to the window. It's snowing.
Osbert stretches his long neck to get a glimpse of the weather. His barbed tail bounces up and down, drumming a happy beat on the floorboards. Our wyvern loves to play in the snow.
After breakfast, could Clara harness Osbert to the little sleigh and take me for a ride to the meadow?
Marin asks.
Please. I feel ever so much better, Auntie.
Well, maybe for a few minutes. Girls of your particular temperament are not meant for the snow, Marin dear.
I am not a mermaid yet, Auntie.
Her familiar pout returns. It makes my heart sing to see her so much herself again.
I suppose, Auntie says, but just a short ride, mind you. We have Christmas gifts to open.
Marin and I wolf down our breakfasts. Auntie indulges our lack of manners. In her eyes, I see her thought. This will be Marin's last Christmas with us. And Auntie cannot tell a lie, cannot even think one. Auntie wraps Marin in coats and capes and every spare blanket she can find while I buckle the red leather harness around the exuberant wyvern. His wings flap snow into my eyes. His wagging tail has swept 3 inches of snow from the ground to reveal sprigs of brown grass. Together, Auntie and I settle Marin into the sleigh. She is light as a feather, even covered in woolens and downfield quilts. Her sparkling face peers out of Auntie's paisley shawl. Has anyone ever been more beautiful than my sister? Just a short trip, Auntie cautions as I lead Osbert across our white-clothed garden. After the kitchen door shuts with a thud, there is silence. The holy silence of winter, broken only by the pings of snowflakes meeting their siblings on the ground and the soft shushing of the sleigh. The glorious meadow twinkles and glimmers in its winter finery. Towering pines stand at its edges like ermine-clad kings. Marin sighs and squeezes my mittened hand. We do not need to speak. From a distance, a sound reaches my ears. First, it seems like the scratching of some animal's claws against metal. As it grows, I recognize the sound of bells. The Halsteads must be taking a sleigh ride, I remark. But a moment later, a small horse trots out of the forest, his black coat almost painful to behold against the white snow. His mane is woven with silver bells and ribbons, and on his back he wears fat saddlebags of green leather, but no saddle. He stops when he sees us and bows his head as if in greeting. Steam rises from his nostrils in roiling clouds. He is darling, Marin says. Her voice is muffled by a thick woolen scarf. You poor frozen deer, I say to the horse. Follow us and we will warm you by our fire. I shake the reins. Home, Osbert. The horse trails behind the sleigh, his bells jingling merrily. What have we here? Auntie says from the doorway. The poor dear, bring him in before he freezes solid. The horse just fits through the kitchen door. Auntie stations him stand by the fire as if he were a human friend come to call, and not an animal that ought to be in the barn. Next, we carry Marin in. She is squirming with delight, enthralled by our odd Christmas visitor. Once Marin is comfortably arranged in the rocker, I shed my coat and scarf and set to rubbing the horse dry. He nickers and nods with gratitude. Now, my fine fellow, Auntie says, might we see what you carry in your pack? Perhaps a clue as to where you ought to be this grand day. The horse nickers again and shakes his mane of silver bells. After Auntie takes the pack from his back, she sets it on the kitchen table. I work to undo one of the buckles, and Auntie works at the other. With sleepy eyes, Marin watches us from the fireside. The horse lies down and places his head next to her steaming footbath. You do the honors, Auntie says to me, stepping aside. I open the flap. On top of several brown papered boxes, I find an envelope. Mrs. Verity Amsel and nieces, it reads. I gasp, recognizing the loopy penmanship. No one but O'Neill has such a hand. It's from O'Neill. But how? I say excitedly. Open it and see, for goodness sake, Auntie urges. Inside, I find 2 letters. One is addressed to Mrs. V. Amsel and also the young Mrs. Marin and Clara. The other is addressed solely to me. I slip my letter into my skirt pocket before tearing open the letter to us all. I read it aloud. Dear ones, I beg your forgiveness for our lack of correspondence, and most especially for not returning in October, as is our habit. Scarf and I have been beset by ill luck since leaving you last summer. We have been burglarized,
We suffered 2 broken wheels in the space of a week, and capsized in a river. A harrowing adventure I will expound upon when I see you again. We also lost our way in a most peculiar forest for 9 days, and recently, both came down with a terrible fever, which even Auntie Verity's best elixirs could not eradicate. As I write this, Job and January are fighting off some sort of equine cough. We are currently camping with a band of jovial gypsies on the banks of an alligator-infested lake. They are good with the horses. The gypsies, not the alligators. Madame Vadoma burns the foulest of incense, swearing that it will keep the toothy reptiles at bay. Yet I do not trust the beasts. The alligators, not the gypsies. There is hunger in their eyes and ill will in their toothy grins. Through all of this, our hearts have been constantly aching to return to you, our dearest friends. How we have fretted over Marin's health. To that effect, we have enclosed a few items she may find helpful. You will find them in the small square box. Scarf begs me to inform you, Auntie, that when we return in spring, he will bring you the one thing your heart and his have most greatly desired for all your years of acquaintance. He says this with an impish smile and will tell me no more of it. Since you are reading this, you have met our friend Zedekiah. I am confident that he will enjoy life with you on Lanfair Mountain, as he has a great affinity for clovers drenched in dew. Scarf and I send our love to you all. If wishing got a body something, we would wish to spend this Christmas in your snug cottage. And now I am imagining Auntie's delectable pies and hot spiced cider and drooling on my best waistcoat. Scarf bids me to stop immediately. Your faithful servants, O'Neill the Magnificent and Ezra Scarf.
Gypsies and alligators. Marin whispers, can it be true?
Of course it is, I say. Why would O'Neill make up such a tale?
To impress us with his brave exploits,
she says. Her words awaken a defensiveness of O'Neill I had not realized was lurking in my heart. I open my mouth to rebuke my sister, but Auntie interrupts.
Shall we see what gifts they sent? Poor Zedekiah carried the burden of them for hundreds of miles, and yet it seems that you girls would rather bicker than open them.
Auntie has her hands on her hips in her best maternal authority pose. Without another word, I peel the brown paper from the first box and remove its lid. Inside are smaller boxes, each adorned with a gilt-edged tag naming the recipient. I deliver Marin's into her hands. She smiles, the sparkles around her eyes glistening. We silently forgive one another for our squabbling. Within my sister's little box is a necklace, a gold locket engraved with an apple tree. She sighs and presses it to her breast before slipping the delicate chain over her head. Auntie coos over her gift, an illuminated book of herbal recipes collected in a volume small enough to fit in her apron pocket.
So thoughtful and practical at the same time, she declares.
Holding my breath, I open the box meant for me. I am ready to be amazed and ready to be disappointed. Wrapped in crinkly paper is a miniature painting in a wooden frame. It could easily fit inside a soup spoon. I hold the scene close and examine its subjects. A white stork perched in a fruit-laden tree, a rippled pond. At the edge of the pond, almost too small to see, is a pink conch shell. Auntie leans in over my shoulder.
O'Neill painted that himself, she says. He was working on it in August when he was here. My, how lovely! Such a talented boy!
I cannot decide whether I am pleased with my gift or jealous of Marin's. I despise myself for such selfishness. Does not my sister deserve all of the best gifts? Her time with us seems to be dwindling so quickly. She may not spend another Christmas with Auntie and me. She may never celebrate the holidays again, for who knows what customs mermaids keep. From each of Marin's ocean-colored eyes falls a pearl the size of the head of a pin. They roll down her pale, twinkling cheeks,
over the smooth silk of her robe and tumble to the floor. She does not try to catch them.
I will miss Christmas most of all the days in the year,
she says, as if she has read my mind.
Come now, Auntie says. We must not dwell on what will or will not be. Today we have Christmas. Today is all we have, my dears. Today is all we ever have.
Despite her brave words, Auntie has tears in her eyes as well. Outside, Osbert scratches at the door and howls. In all the excitement over Zedekiah, we left our faithful wyvern in the snow. Auntie lifts the latch and he bolts across the kitchen, dragging a snowdrift in with his tail. Little icicles hang from his chin like a beard. His wings stick out stiffly at his sides. Merrin laughs as he turns three circles in front of the fire and flops onto his belly with a pitiful moan. Auntie places a basin of warm peppermint tea under Osbert's snout.
Merry Christmas to you, beast, she says. There's your favorite.
After we open the other packages, a tin of dried seaweed, six oranges, several yards of scarlet and black brocade, two drawing pencils, a harmonica, eight well-polished clamshells, and a jar of vanilla beans. I slip away to the bedroom to read my letter from O'Neill. Perched on the edge of the bed, I stare at the loops and swirls that make up my name. What was he thinking when he penned the letters? That he missed me? That he missed his almost sister? Or that he needed to hurry and get to his chores? Or into the arms of some lovely gypsy girl? My trembling fingers pry the flap loose and the letter falls into my lap. The folded paper is onion skin thin. Words crisscross over words like the dark tracks of ice skates upon a frozen pond. With great care, I coax the missive flat and begin to read.
Dear Clara, I hope this letter finds you well and that Zedekiah has arrived before Christmas. He promised to do his utmost to reach you before December's end. I am writing to you privately because I do not wish to alarm Auntie. But I feel compelled to tell you the truth, dearest friend. That truth is, Scarf is quite unwell. The fever has left him weak as a kitten, yet he manages to cough as if he might bring up a lung. His clothes are suddenly too large for him. I wish that I could deliver him into Auntie's care, as I know she could fatten him up and restore his vim and vigor in no time. Unfortunately, Scarf is constrained by rules that you and I cannot comprehend. Rules that dictate the days and seasons he may set foot upon your splendid mountain. This is a mystery to me, as I know it is to you. In Auntie's stead, the incense-burning gypsy Madame Vadoma looks after him in her way. She is 100 years old if she is a day, and seems to have a way with medicines and charms. Scarf is as gruff as a bear with her, but it only makes her cackle. How I miss you and Merrin. My greatest fear is that the mermaid will overtake her before I return. I enclose Madame Vadoma's receipt for a tisane that she claims will slow the transformation and ease any pain Merrin might have. I beg you to try it, with Auntie's permission, of course. Please tear the receipt from this letter and then burn it. I mean burn the letter, not the receipt. In the spring, we will dance in the orchard with the honeybees. I will teach you how to eat fire and throw knives, skills my gypsy friends have taught me. These things I swear, dear Clara, by all the alligators in the lake. Your faithful servant, O'Neill. Madame Vadoma's receipt for Merrin. 2 teaspoons dried seaweed. Shredded rind of half orange. 1 teaspoon dried lavender flowers. 1/2 teaspoon salt, preferably sea salt. 2 pinches of crushed clamshell, use mortar and pestle to make like sand. 1 strand of hair from the person who needs this medicine. Dash of black pepper. Tie ingredients inside a square of cotton cloth and steep in 1 cup of boiled water for 5 minutes. Add 1 teaspoon of honey and drink all within 3 minutes with eyes closed and a silver coin in left hand. Drink once before breakfast and once at bedtime.
I read the letter again and again.
Why does O'Neill's odd penmanship make it difficult for me to breathe?
In spite of his instructions, I tear the letter into 3 pieces. One is the receipt to give to Auntie. One is the paragraph in which O'Neill promises to dance with me and teach me to eat fire. And one is the rest of the letter. I set the receipt on the nightstand. I tuck the paragraph about dancing and fire eating beneath my pillow. I toss the largest section into the coals of the bedroom's fireplace and watch as the paper turns gray and then black before bursting into flame. Watching the flames, I picture O'Neill. He extends his arms and I step into them as a shower of apple blossoms descends around us. He begins to hum, and we waltz around the apple tree. There is no one else in the world but us, and I am happy. It is one more wish for my collection. Auntie is asleep in her chair by the fire, her embroidery hoop in her lap. Osbert snores beside Marin's footbath. Marin hums softly, a song I do not know. If I had to give it words, it would tell of undersea princesses riding dolphins to their undersea weddings. My sister seems content. Perhaps it is only my imagination, but I think her countenance has brightened since Auntie dosed her with Madame Vadoma's tisane. Although less than an hour has passed since Marin drank the murky, dark green liquid. A glint of gold on the mantel shelf catches my eye. Gold ribbon wrapped around a tiny cherry wood box. Simon's Christmas gift to Marin. How could I have forgotten it all this time? I take the box down and give it to Marin. A note is tucked beneath the ribbon. Will you read it, sister?
Marin asks.
Reading tires me so.
I can see several rows of silver-edged scales through the fabric of her nightgown, ending just above the curve of her hip. She never wears a proper dress anymore. A corset would be unbearable, for it would crush her new scales. Besides, mermaids were not meant for clothes. Even the thinnest of nightgowns seems to irritate her. I unfold the note. Are you sure I should read it? It is from Simon. It may be private.
Read,
she says. She closes her eyes, and I begin.
Dearest, darling Marin, here is a gift for you. It is very special. I bought it at the medicine show on the second night when you were not with me, from the woman who sang and almost sold us gloves. She said it was from her country, and that if you kept it close to you, it would ease any sufferings you might have. She seemed to think you were unwell. Regardless, I thought it pretty. But not as pretty as you, my dearest darling. Ever yours, Simon David Shumsky.
I groan. Dearest darling? Ugh.
He cannot help his feelings, I suppose,
Marin says. She lifts the lid of the box and takes out a small stone. It is deep brown with a stripe of bronze down the center, like the eye of a cat.
It is rather pretty.
She pries open the locket O'Neill sent and places the stone inside.
It will be safe there. And if it has the magic the woman said it does, it will be close enough to me to do its work. Perhaps it will lessen the pain of changing. At times it is almost more than I can bear.
I will be glad if it helps you. But I do not think that anything they sold at the show was genuine, I say. Remember how Auntie had to make special tonics for many of the villagers who took Dr. Phipps's mixtures? Marin yawns.
Yes, but this is only a bit of rock. What harm could it do?
Auntie awakens with a start.
Goodness me, it's nigh on midnight. Time for bed, my girls.
Auntie and I each put an arm about Marin's shoulders and help her hobble to bed. We wrap her greenish-blue legs in damp towels and kiss her goodnight.
Merry Christmas, sister,
Marin and I say at the same moment. A tiny pearl rolls down Marin's cheek and onto her pillow.
I lay down with her and press my hand against her cool, glittering cheek. We have had the best of Christmases, haven't we, dear? Snow and gifts from Scarf and O'Neill, that funny little horse, and Auntie's good food. I am grateful for it. And you. I swallow hard, tasting unshed tears in the back of my throat. She closes her eyes.
I wonder if they celebrate Christmas beneath the sea. If I will.
Her voice is fading again. Whatever Christmas miracle returned it to her is diminishing. That is a mystery, I say. A very great mystery. Next year, unless O'Neill procures a very great miracle to reverse the change, she will know for certain what the merfolk do at Christmas. Will she send a message by seagull to share with me the customs they keep in the deep? Will she send gifts of sea glass and pirates' lost coins? Will she remember us at all? Time will tell. Chapter 8. In my nighttime dreams, I am brave. Marin rides behind me on Zedekiah. He is not the small horse who has taken up residence in the barn with our three goats. He is a splendid stallion, 16 hands high, regal and fearless. He carries us over mountains and through rivers, across barren plains and through tangled forests. I sit up as straight and tall as a princess, but I am dressed as a boy, and a long sword bounces against my leg with each of Zedekiah's prancing steps. We journey through many days and nights until we reach the sea. Zedekiah gallops into the water. He slows as the water reaches his chest and stops altogether when it reaches the base of his neck. Something is approaching, moving fluidly toward us, moving fast under a layer of water as thin as glass. I draw my sword. Out of the water appears the head of a giant seahorse, and enthroned upon the seahorse is a bare-chested man, or rather, a bare-chested merman. His hair is white and as wild as the waves, and his crown is made of coral and pearls. His fishy half starts just below his navel, scales of iridescent green and orange and gold. His brow is furrowed, but he is smiling.
Daughter,
he says, his ocean-colored eyes on my sister. He urges the seahorse closer and reaches for her. Stand down, I command. We have not come to surrender, but to demand that you release her from your realm. We demand that you grant her freedom from the sea and return her to her human form. My sword is pointed at his head. I do not tremble before this king. He laughs with the sound of a thousand waves crashing into the sands of a thousand beaches. Still, I neither tremble nor back down. Release her, I say, or your blood shall mingle with these waters. With a slap of his tail, the merman bids the seahorse to charge. He raises his trident, and in that instant, I swipe at him with my sword. I miss. The points of his trident press into my chest.
Silly girl, he bellows. Would you exchange your life for her freedom?
Yes, I say without hesitation. Yes.
So be it,
he says. He draws his weapon back and then thrusts it toward my heart. I awaken with a start and a cry. Could I ever be as brave as the dream version of myself? I do not believe so. The kitchen is quiet, save for the crackle of the fire, the arrhythmic clicking of my knitting needles, and the occasional swish of pages being turned by Auntie. Marin dozes in the rocker, and Osbert huddles beside her soaking feet. Perhaps the foot-deep layer of snow on and about our cottage conceals the sound of Simon Shumsky's carriage. Perhaps Osbert has fallen into some sort of wyvern hibernation. Regardless,
Osbert does not provide his usual warning of unwanted company. The knock on the door sends him flying to the cellar.
Oh, my stars, Auntie says as she gets to her feet. He's here to take our Merrin to the dance.
We must get rid of him before he sees her, I say.
The door is thrown open.
Good evening, ladies,
Simon says, stepping into the kitchen. He wears a new coat and hat and an eager smile.
Is Merrin ready?
Somehow, miracle of miracles, he does not notice Merrin fast asleep under her mound of dampened shawls. To distract him, I say,
let me make you a cup of tea. You must be half frozen.
I take his arm and direct him to a seat at the table.
Dear heavens, Auntie says, I hate to disappoint you, Simon, especially since you came all this way in the cold.
But she is better now, isn't she?
His brow furrows with what I read as worry mixed with frustration.
No, Simon, she is still unwell. I have done all that I can, but she is not fit to go out in the cold. She is in no way strong enough for dancing.
Auntie says gently but firmly. I set the tea in front of him. We should have sent word. We are very sorry. There will be other dances, I say.
Other dances for him, but not for Merrin.
Auntie pulls a chair close to him.
Simon, may I speak plainly?
He nods and drinks down his tea as though it is medicine.
Merrin has a condition from which she cannot be cured. I know that you love her, but I must tell you that she can never marry any man,
Auntie says in her most soothing voice. Fat tears stand at the edges of Simon's eyes.
Never?
What is worse, Simon, is that I must ask you not to visit again. She will become rather disfigured, and I know it would distress her to have you see her in such a state.
One great sob escapes Simon before he regains his composure.
Forgive me,
he says. There is nothing to forgive, I say. Why should you ask forgiveness for being devoted to Merrin? For loving her?
I am sorry,
he says. He stands and walks toward the door like a sleepwalker. He does not say goodbye and forgets to close the door behind him. Osbert creeps up from the cellar. Auntie shuts the door and sighs.
The poor man, his heart is broken.
Was that true love, Auntie? I pick up Simon's empty cup.
Indeed, she says.
I wish... I do not know what I wish. Chapter 9. A peculiar change in the weather melts all the snow on New Year's Day and brings another pair of visitors to our cottage. With a basket containing 3 eggs, and we are lucky the winter-hating chickens produced that many, I walk the gravel path between the hen house and the cottage. Presently, I hear the wheels of an approaching wagon, but alas, the music of odd chimes and banging pots does not accompany it. It is the wagon belonging to Peterman and Sons, the village's general store. Mr. Peterman, a spry gentleman on the far side of 60, jumps down from the seat as nimbly as a cat. His plump son, Henry Donald, heaves himself to the frozen ground with a thud. Good afternoon, gentlemen, I say. What brings you up the mountain?
Oh, it is good to see you, Miss Clara,
Mr. Peterman grins, doffing his hat.
Nothing like a pretty girl to warm a man's chilled heart and soul.
Hello, Miss Clara,
Henry Donald says. His chapped cheeks redden further as he stares at his boots, the image of a schoolboy caught with a love letter. The poor fellow is 40 years old and as shy as a fawn.
There you are, Auntie calls from the doorway. Have you brought my special order?
Yes, ma'am, Mr. Peterman replies. It arrived at the store a week ago, but with the weather being such as it was, we couldn't get up here till now.
Auntie and I watch as the two men place planks from the wagon bed to the ground to form a ramp.
At Henry Donald's count of three, they lift a large wooden crate and carry it off the wagon.
"Where do you want it, Mrs. Amsel?"
Mr. Peterman asks as he walks backward toward the cottage.
"Well, for now you can put it in the girls' room,"
Auntie says. She opens the door wide and steps aside.
"Straight through there," she says, "the room on the left, just after the grandfather clock."
With groans and scrapings of doorways, the Petermans reach their destination. I follow them, wondering what the box might hold and where my sister is hiding. Mr. Peterman takes a hammer from his belt and uses its claw end to pry off the top of the crate and then to pry apart the sides. The wood falls away to reveal a 6-foot-long metal tub, dark silver inside and painted pine green on the outside.
"That's a beauty," Mr. Peterman says, patting the edge. "If my wife were to catch sight of it, she'd take a notion to get one for herself."
"It is quite pretty," Auntie says, "and it should do our Marin a world of good. She has troubles with her legs and feet, you see, and nothing makes her feel better than a good soak. Now, come into the kitchen and have a nice hot cup of tea and some raisin cake before you go."
After Auntie ushers Mr. Peterman and Henry Donald into the kitchen, I climb into the tub.
Imagine! A bathtub! We have never had such a luxury, but have never wanted it either. Our warm weather bathing has always consisted of joyful splashing in the creek, and in winter time we squeeze ourselves into the wash tub once a week. I imagine steaming water swirling about me, the scent of Auntie's good lavender soap. And then I remember what Auntie said about Marin and her troubles. And I realize that this tub is not for baths. It will be Marin's home, like a fishbowl for a half-fish girl. Leaving the tub behind and not liking it half so much as I had at first, I tiptoe across the hall to Auntie's tiny bedroom. "There you are," I say to Marin. She is lying on Auntie's bed, wrapped in wet towels. Her eyes are half closed. From the end of the towels protrudes a single silver-green fin. My stomach lurches. Without asking permission, I peel back the towels to look at what should be 2 feet and 2 legs. "Oh, Marin," I sigh. "My poor sister." Tears fall from my eyes and splatter upon her fused together legs. A single limb, embellished with rows of small, glassy scales, like the ones that first appeared on her sides last summer.
"Don't cry, Clara,"
she whispers. Her voice is the swish of sea foam on sand.
"Your poor legs."
I stroke what used to be her pale calf.
"They hurt less now that they are one."
I shake my head. I have no words. Carefully, I climb onto the bed and nestle beside her, my head on her damp shoulder. And silently, I weep for her loss, for my loss of her.
"Hush now,"
she whispers in her gentle, tired voice.
"I must be what I am, dear, as much as it pains me to leave you."
"If only I was already a stork. If only I had wings to carry me, I would fly until I found a cure for you. I would fly until my last feather dropped to the earth."
"I know, sister. Hush now. Can't you hear the seabird's wings above us? Can you not hear the sailors singing as they unfurl their great sails? Can you not hear the low bellows of the whales speaking to their children in the deepest deep?"
"No," I think. "I hear nothing but the sound of my heart breaking into a million tiny pieces, each smaller than a single grain of sand." Winter is long. Long, cold, dark, and tiresome. Not like our former winters,
when we played checkers and knuckle bones, made up two-person plays for Auntie's amusement, sang songs beside the fire, and attempted to learn French and lace-making. Both the lace-making and the French studies proved abysmal failures. Not like the evenings when we planned aloud our futures, futures that more often than not involved marrying handsome foreigners and living in fine houses built side by side, our tribes of happy children frolicking in our shared gardens. Not like the evenings when Auntie would tell us fairy stories and stories of her youth, which sometimes seemed to overlap and entwine. Those were cozy, lovely, snug times in our cottage home. These winter months, Marin reclines in the bathtub day and night. She spends hours smoothing her lovely hair with the tortoiseshell comb O'Neill gave her for her 16th birthday. Day by day, her hair changes, growing longer and more coppery, speckled with glittery flecks. It cascades in waves over her shoulders and floats on the surface of the water like tendrils of an exotic vine. Auntie wraps Marin from underarms to waist in lengths of bright cotton, for modesty's sake. For the mermaid girl is now fully fish from the waist down and has no use for dresses or skirts. "Is there nothing more you can do?" I ask Auntie for the thousandth time as we carry empty buckets back to the kitchen. "Is there no possible way to make her human again?" The foolish questions spill from my mouth, although I know full well what Auntie will say. Marin never was, and never will be, truly human. Nevertheless, I ask, because my heart and mind refuse to quit quarreling, because love and truth are in a tangle that I wish to unravel. "No, my girl," Auntie shakes her head sadly, "and I fear that she will soon sicken. Mermaids belong in the ocean, not the bath. If only Scarf were here to help us, surely he could find a way to take her to her kind. But alas, it is February, and he never comes before mid-March." I bite my lower lip. If she had but an inkling of Scarf's condition, she might truly despair. "We must try to keep her well until he comes, then." "Yes. I only hope that we are not causing her undue pain by giving her tisanes and potions to slow the change. Sometimes it is unwise to tamper with the inevitable. I do not think she has much pain anymore. Whenever I catch her crying, she says it is only because she is homesick for the sea." We set the buckets down and sit at the kitchen table. "If I could leave this place," Auntie says, her eyes awash with regret. "But I cannot." "Perhaps I should try to take her," I say, well aware that Auntie has not set foot off the mountain since long before my birth. Indeed, the thought makes my stomach clench with fear, but I speak on. "The worst of winter is likely past, and the roads are clear enough for the wagon. Zedekiah is small, but he could manage to pull Marin and me. I could dress like a boy to be safe, and when O'Neill arrives, you could send him to join us." My voice sounds foreign to me, my words like someone else's. Auntie wraps her wrinkled fingers about my wrist. "You do not have to prove your love for Marin to me, my dear, nor to her. Let us wait a little longer for Scarf and O'Neill. If they do not appear by March, I will consider your offer." She smiles faintly. Whether to reassure herself or me, I cannot tell. I attempt a smile of my own, for Auntie's sake alone. "I know you have done everything you could for Marin, Auntie. I only want to be able to say the same for myself." She neither agrees nor disagrees, just pats my shoulder. "I will make tea," she says, "and we will cling to what hope we have." The days are a blur of repetition. I read to Marin. I sing to her. She smiles wistfully when I recount our childhood adventures,
especially ones involving the mischief O'Neill always got us into. While she naps, I clasp her damp hand and daydream of happier times. I admit that I daydream of O'Neill more than any other subject, perhaps more than I should. But thoughts of him shore up my heart with moments of much-needed joy. I think perhaps I love him more each day. Is that how true love works? I will not ask Auntie. Every few hours, I scoop buckets of cooled water from the tub and refill it with water from the kettles Auntie heats continually on the wood stove. I add handfuls of coarse salt. When people come up from the village in need of remedies, Auntie closes the bedroom door firmly, with a discreet turning of key in lock, saying that Marin is not her usual self. Auntie always tells the truth. One afternoon, while Auntie is filling bottles of coffee elixir in the kitchen, Marin naps, and I am drowsing over Robinson Crusoe. A tapping at our bedroom window startles me. Just the wind, I think. I begin to reread page 37 for what must be the 37th time. And then it happens again. Turning my head, I see a dark shape outside the frost-starred pane. After setting the book on the mattress, I tiptoe to the window. The tapping is pecking, I realize, as I discern the outline of a bird. As soon as I open the window, the bird swoops into the room, accompanied by a bone-chilling blast of wind. With all my strength, I push the pane back into place and turn the latch. Awakened by the commotion, Marin watches the raven perch on the edge of the tub and bow its head in salute. She applauds and laughs in tiny gasps. I have not seen her so delighted since her last autumn's swim in the wishing pool.
Craw!
Calls the raven, shaking one leg in my direction. Tied to the leg with a red string is a piece of brown paper. What have you here? I say to the bird as I work to undo the complicated knot. Sorry, Mr. Raven, I'm doing my best. Finally, the string gives way and the paper slips to the floor.
A message?
Marin asks in her soft ocean breeze voice. We shall see. I retrieve the paper and it unfolds itself in the palm of my hand like an enchanted flower. I recognize the handwriting immediately and my heart rejoices. It is from O'Neill. Marin claps her hands, sending water drops flying onto the raven and me.
Read it, she mouths, out loud.
Of course, I reply. The message says, oh my, such tiny print. I bring the paper closer to my face and angle it to catch the firelight. There, I say, and begin.
Dear Clara, Marin, and Verity, I present to you the good raven Pilsner. He is a gift from our gypsy friends, a bird of extraordinary talent. He brings to you our fondest greetings and our news. And our news is this. Scarf is much improved, and Job and January in fine fettle. We leave here very soon and hope to be with you by 1st of March. We beseech you, dear ladies, to keep well until we meet again. And ever after, of course. Yours faithfully, O'Neill, and Scarf also. Postscript. Pilsner has a great fondness for cheese. The sharper the better.
With a contented smile and a wriggle of her mermaid tail, Marin sinks a bit lower into the water. Pilsner hops along the edge of the tub until he reaches the point closest to the fireplace. He ruffles his feathers and closes his eyes, his task well done. O'Neill is coming, my heart sings. In 2 short weeks, he will be here with us. In spite of Auntie's predictions of Marin's fate, I dare to hope that he might rescue us from our loss of her yet, that he might bring a charm or a potion or something that will make her fully human again, that he will be the hero who can change this tale of woe into a happily ever after story. Perhaps I am a fool. No. I know I am a fool.
Why else would I keep wishing for a way for Marin to become a girl again when Auntie's wise words echo in my head 100 times each day? There is no cure for being who you truly are.
Why else would I wish something for my sister that she does not wish for herself?
Marin flicks her tail and droplets of water fly into my face. Her eyes twinkle with mischief.
You look far too glum for having read such good news, she whispers.
She flings another finful of water my direction and drenches my dress. I grab the pitcher from the washstand and empty it over Marin's head. She pushes wet strands of hair away from her eyes and laughs, a sound like little waves lapping at pebbles.
That was nice, she says. Lovely.
She extends a hand and I take it. For a moment, we are nothing but the sisters we have been for 17 years. Without warning, she yanks hard, pulling me into the tub with her. We laugh ourselves breathless and then lay still. She holds me in her arms and I do not struggle. The water is warm and my sister's embrace is a rare and sweet thing.
I wish you were a mermaid,
Marin whispers. I close my eyes and try to think of how to answer her, but words fail me. Chapter 10. Pilsner follows Auntie about like a winged, two-legged puppy. He is utterly devoted to her, as she was to him after a mere hour of acquaintance. She feeds him bits of our best cheese, morsels of apples and pears. We griddle cakes studded with sunflower seeds and raisins, all arranged prettily on a blue-flowered saucer. At night, he perches on her bedpost like a black-plumed guardian angel. And as O'Neill said in his note, Pilsner is a bird of extraordinary talent. If his only talents had been the finding of dropped sewing needles and lost buttons, besides the delivery of letters from afar, he would have been amazing enough. But he is also a fine opponent at checkers and a gifted dancer. His best talent of all, however, is making our Marin laugh. Osbert's jealousy is both pitiful and comical. His attempts to be a